Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Welcome to the Progressive Britain podcast. This is the podcast with the unpopular belief that progressive centre-left politics has a lot to offer the modern world. We've seen a number of stories recently, from the Me Too movement to Windrush, that have pushed the equalities agenda to the forefront of the political conversation. But few issues have been as contentious as the debate on the reform of the Gender Recognition Act and the wider role of trans people in political and public life. I'm the Director of Progress, Richard Angel, and I'm joined by Progress Deputy Director, Stephanie Lloyd, and Heather Pito, LGBT Labour's trans officer and candidate for Le Parti NEC. We're here to discuss trans rights and the next frontier of the equalities agenda. Before we get to some of the thorny and thoughtful issues around trans equality, it is obviously polling week and Progress will be out on the doorstep campaigning for Labour candidates up and down the country, trying to win important victories for our party. In particular, we're focusing on London, where we've got councils not only everywhere up for election, but it looks like Labour's going to win places we've never really won before. So Barnet, we've never had a majority Labour council previously, and it looks like that looks very possible up in North London. And then both Wanstead and Westminster could fall Labour. And if we're really lucky, Labour could take Kensington and Chelsea, where of course we won a Labour MP at the 2017 general election with a majority of just 22 votes. It's all to play for out there. The polls are in our favour. Labour's tails are up. Everyone's out campaigning across the country. And it's not just London where we could see victories for Labour. Trafford in Manchester could go Labour. We could win Amber Valley in the East Midlands. And North East Lincolnshire looks like a cert to turn red in these elections. Heather, I know you've been out campaigning not just to get yourself on the NEC, talking about the issues of Europe, dealing with sexual harassment and making sure we have regional representation on the NEC, but you've been doing your fair share of campaigning. Have you found it?
Yes, I mean, I've been campaigning mainly in Derby and Amber Valley in the East Midlands, and there's been a fairly positive response. I mean, I think things are still coloured by the Brexit issue. So, you know, we start off with local issues, and then it seems to deteriorate into Brexit, which can be both positive and negative. So in Derby, there's a big impact if we leave the customs union on companies that, such as Rolls-Royce and Bombardier and Toyota, who are all dependent upon the customs union for their supply chain. So in particular in Derby, a lot of people fear that their jobs are at risk, and that is becoming an issue in the local elections.
And for that reason, Progress had on the back of the last magazine, we published Keir's six tests, one of which is that we get the benefits of the customs union and the single market in the deal that the Prime Minister comes back with, because there are companies all around the country, not just the financiers in the City of London, but the manufacturers who are based out in the East Midlands, where obviously you campaign, Heather, that really are reliant on the products that move seamlessly currently between a factory in Germany through to something in the UK that then goes back out to Greece and then comes via Spain and is finally made in Sunderland, for example. And so this is really, really important. It's interesting that that's coming out. Are you getting people who are hardening their position for Brexit?
There are a few people who are hardening their views towards Brexit in terms of they are still taking this view that we must stop immigration. And so that is a fairly negative conversation that we have on the doorsteps. However, when you say sort of like you're working alongside people that come from the European Union, they all say, oh, yes, but, you know, Fred over there is great to work with. I don't mean him. I just mean the others.
That's often the case, isn't it? If you can get it off of immigrants and onto even a particular nationality or a route that people come through or where you work with them or experience them. When I get immigration on the doorstep, the first thing I say to people is, how is that issue affecting you? Because suddenly you change the nature of the conversation. It goes from the hysteria of the Daily Mail through to, oh, well, they're my colleague, or I just got treated in the NHS by somebody who's doesn't originate from the UK or whatever it might be. And it does mean you can have a nicer dialogue about it going forward. I mean, sadly, these voters haven't read the previous edition of Progress that looked at the issues of controlling free movement while keeping in the single market, which I think is a failure of some of our politicians to not be able to talk about that solution going forward. That's interesting you've had both of those experiences. Steph, I know you've been out in London more because obviously we're London-centric, being living here and all.
Living here and all, yeah.
Have you found Brexit coming up on the doorstep?
I definitely have. I think maybe less so in London in the sense that it's obviously a very kind of pro-European, particularly in lots of the areas that we're knocking on. Lots of that's very pro-European, more people worried that we're leaving more than anything else. But lots of kind of more day-to-day issues in terms of housing, particularly as a big issue that's coming up, whether that's people who already own their own homes and want their children to be able to have access to that, or people like myself that are totally priced out of the housing market. So
yeah, I've been kind of finding there's almost two issues in the London elections. There's a kind of competence issue and a culture issue. So if you live in Barnet, you've had a Tory council that's privatised everything to the nth degree. If you're in Wanstead, you've got council tax that's so low, which arguably people like, but they've got nothing to show for no council tax. There are no public services anymore. Westminster, it's a kind of middle ground, actually, I think, on that position, but still a sense that the council's kind of running out of ideas and just kind of flogging a dead horse, if you will, on the delivery of public services locally. The second is a series of kind of culture issues are coming up. And it seems that there's a kind of conflation of the fact that the Tory government has got nothing good to say about itself and no reason to ask people to vote Tory. So surprisingly, I don't think people are going to go out and vote for them, which is obviously a good thing. You've got the cultural issues around being Remainers in a Remain city, and particularly you feel that. And one of the things I found is going out in some of the better off places in Wandsworth is they were very much identifying with Labour because of the Remain issue. But also, there seems to be a very long tail on the Zach Goldsmith campaign against Sadiq Khan.
Absolutely.
And that will only have been made worse by the Windrush situation, where the government has got itself by choice, by policy decision of the previous Home Secretary, who has a new and quite important job, I forget what it is.
Prime Minister.
Oh, that one. Is there's a real cultural issue. And the Tories, I think, believe that they could divide and rule broadly amongst Asian and ethnic minority voters on being anti-Muslim, that they would therefore try and get the votes from other communities. And what that campaign showed is actually there was real solidarity across London. And I think there's a real interesting solidification of people who don't have to necessarily come from an Asian or ethnic minority background that see those three cultural issues conflating and are therefore going to back Labour. So I think Thursday is going to be a really good night for Labour, particularly obviously in London. But you know, the fact that a council like Trafford could go Labour, we're obviously hopeful about Amber Valley, North East Lincolnshire, and there are obviously others around the country, you know, suggests that while our tails are up and we're out with something positive to say, we're going to get the rewards for that. And that is a really good opportunity. While we've got you, Heather, I wanted to ask about one more thing. The team of candidates standing for the NEC have been campaigning to regionalise the NEC. So rather have a national block of nine people elected to make sure there is somebody from the East Midlands, the North East, Wales, etc. How have you found that been taken up by party members and activists across the country?
So it's been very positive in the East Midlands. Actually, going back, this comes again to a Brexit issue. The East Midlands and many regions that are economically not as well off as London and the South East, they were quite dependent and are still quite dependent upon the EU Regional Development Funds. And we found our local governments have been losing power because they've been losing money, and so have less influence on their local economies, because there's, you know, those are additional services, not compulsory or statutory services that council has to provide. So by actually sort of saying to people within the East Midlands, look, come up with ideas of what you would want in a Labour manifesto regionally. So would we have a regional manifesto for the East Midlands? It's a possibility, but certainly something that we'd address in the national manifesto has been very, very popular. Alongside, I have to say, my pro-European, let's not leave the EU, let's actually invest in the regions, use the actual money that we'd not lose in taxation by actually leaving the EU to actually invest in the regions and tackle people's underlying grievances.
So you've not just found party members supporting the idea that we want to say over, you know, what selections are happening in our area or by-elections that might come up, but also just they think they're going to get a more decentralised politics by having a more decentralised set of voices on the NEC.
Yes, I think this is actually something that Labour could really benefit from in an election, actually having a regional manifesto, certainly in areas whereby we feel left behind, because the East Midlands does feel left behind, the North East does feel left behind. And if we can address our particular issues that were coming up in the East Midlands in a separate manifesto or as part of the broader manifesto targeting particularly those regions, I think that would be very popular. And people want that input.
Yeah, I think also, I totally agree with Heather in terms of the way that it will shape the politics of the Labour Party. But also, I think it's a basic democracy issue as well. It's the idea, you know, one of the fundamentals in terms of having a good democracy internally as a party is also being able to hold someone to account. So it's not just about being able to elect them and how you do that, but it's about the whole process of everything afterwards. And one of the biggest problems is when you've got a mass membership, which is a very good thing in the way that the Labour Party now does, how do you hold to account these nine people? Like, how do you have any meaningful interaction with lots of the membership if it's not done, you know, and the regionalisation way of doing it?
Regionally, you could go and report back at your regional conference.
There are so many different ways. You could probably
go and visit, certainly in a two-year term, most CLPs in your region. There is no way, even if you had some kind of comradely way of divvying up the country as the block of nine, you couldn't go and visit everywhere in that sense. That's not a feasible or possible.
No, and it's one of those things where it allows someone who has a real depth of understanding of the local area and a real understanding and connection to that to be able to really be a representative of that area. And it also allows people to be able to run much more feasibly and not have to try and run and convince 600,000 people, but actually be able to kind of run on an area and make that much more inclusive.
So I'm going to bring that discussion to an end now. Remind people that just after polling day is Progress Annual Conference, which is one of the best parts of our calendar as an organisation. We've got some absolutely brilliant speakers lined up to be at that event. Obviously, Alistair Campbell is going to start off the day with what we think will be a tub-thumping speech for both the future of the Labour Party and our membership of the European Union as a country. But we've got other great people from across the Labour family coming along. So if you haven't got your tickets yet, book them now.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hi, I'm June Sarpong, and if you like the Progressive Britain podcast, then we ask you to subscribe, rate, or review it on iTunes, because that's how we reach a larger audience. And that's what progressive politics is all about.
One of the many successes of the last Labour government was a pioneering piece of little-known legislation, the Gender Recognition Act. It allowed transgender people to have it recognised in their birth certificate, the gender of which they wish to live going forward in their lives. And it allowed them to do it in a way that gave a strong legal framework and at the time was seen as a real frontier for LGBT people in this country. And really the first time, I think, trans people had been properly recognised in UK law, and it was much celebrated. But much time has passed and things move with it. There were some unintended consequences. In 2015-16, the Women and Equalities Committee did a transgender inquiry and it looked at some of the many issues that came up. And it concluded that the government must bring forward proposals to update the Gender Recognition Act in line with the principles of gender self-declaration that have been developed in other jurisdictions. In recent years, we've seen that move forward in a whole number of countries around us, not least Ireland, which of course sits on our border, has a very similar legal structure to the UK. This has meant we've had a tsunami of discussion around trans equality, arguably by people in many cases who've been ill-informed about it, some people who have been trying to whip up hate, and some people who have rightly been trying to make the case for the need for change. I think it's an issue where emotions run high on all sides. Some people have been trying to have this debate as if it's on the Today programme, but conducted via Twitter. And it's been neither comradely or conducted in a constructive way. And there's been much abuse involved. But I think before we get into some of the very real issues that come up with the reality of the current law, the need for change and the consequences that might have, we should really reflect on where trans people find themselves in society now. So visibility is higher. We have trans idols in the country. We're starting to go beyond the firsts and we're seeing Paris Lees appear on mainstream media in a very proactive way. Fashion magazines are having trans women on the front page of their editions, and it's becoming part of our national conversation in many ways in a positive way, but it hasn't always been. So, Heather, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about how you live in the world as a trans person and some of what that has meant for you in a very real way.
Yes, well, I mean, being trans has improved significantly over the last 20 to 30 years. I mean, when I first transitioned, I'd be regularly beaten up and quite severely, about once a year on average. And I'm pleased to say that doesn't actually happen so much now. There was used to be a lot of verbal abuse on the streets. People are, by and large, a lot more tolerant now. And so lots of trans people have felt that found their lives have improved a great deal, partly because the internet has actually allowed people who are previously isolated to find other transgender people and get support online from one another. But unfortunately, the internet has also a darker side. We have Twitter and we have Facebook, where you can have trolls out there who throw lots of abuse at transgender people. So that can make life very, very difficult. The workplaces in general have, by and large, improved for transgender people. And the Gender Recognition Act has made a big difference. And so has the Equality Act, preventing discrimination or intentional discrimination against transgender people.
And Stephanie Stonewall, the organisation set up following Margaret Thatcher's pernicious Section 28, started as an LGB organisation, but under its new chief executive, or she's not new in the role anymore, but the most recent chief executive, has really taken on the trans issue. And I know they've done some research looking at some of the issues for trans people.
Yeah, they have indeed. And I think some of the statistics, and I think it's worth taking the time just to kind of sit and think about the reality of some of this and what this means. So when you look at some of them, so, you know, over 83 percent of trans young people have experienced name calling or verbal abuse. I don't think that will shock particularly many of us. But when you think that almost half of trans people in Britain have attempted suicide at least once, and 84% of people, of trans people, have thought about it. When you think of the scale of what that is, and this is the reality
that
of what...
That is basically everyone.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the thing, you know, you look at the fact that almost 70% of trans people avoid certain places or situations for fear of being abused, threatened or harassed. You know, more than 50% of trans people experience negative comments whilst they're at work. One in four have been discriminated specifically against whilst they were at work. And it's one of those things where when you think of the statistics and how that works, you think of the verbal abuse, you think of the discrimination at work, you think of places that you won't go, people that you won't talk to. That is why you end up with the statistics at the end where it is that almost half of trans people in this country have attempted to take their own life. Like, that is the reality and the seriousness of the transphobia in this country and what it faces.
I think that's useful, I think, for going into some of the wider conversations about to have. So let's take a step back. Let's start this process with the Gender Recognition Act. Heather, tell us a little bit about why that law came about. What was the pressing need for change at that time?
So basically, you were always able since the 1970s to change things like your passport and your driving license to change it to recognise the gender that you were living as. But you were not able to change your birth certificate. And that caused various legal consequences, which we might come on to, but difficulties over insurance, for example, but also difficulties over your privacy, because lots of trans people want to pass in the gender that they live in. And by passing, what I mean is that people would not call them out for being transgender. They're happily living as a woman or happily living as a man, and all the people that they're associated with, you know, just treat them as that. The trouble was that if you had a particular person, and you've seemed to have a lot of these around who, you know, really want to go stalker-like and investigate someone's past because they think, oh, that person might be trans, they were able to get hold of the birth certificate or the original birth registration and say, no, Heather was not always Heather. Heather was whatever their previous name was, and that's called dead naming, where your previous name and your previous gender and perhaps photographs were published of you. So the Gender Recognition Act was in part to actually help protect people's privacy. It was certainly there to help change some of these legal ambiguities that you would have if you weren't able to change your birth certificate.
So that, I think that's a really important place to start, is that this was a piece of legislation that only covers essentially your birth certificate and what it says and how it says it. Because if you follow some of the debate that's come afterwards, you'd believe that it was much more wide ranging than that. So you alluded to some of the consequences of not having that previously. For example, insurance. Explain that to our listeners.
Yes, okay. So to give an example, in 2001, I'd changed my passport to recognise my female gender, and that had all my name and everything changed. When I came to fill in my insurance, then I was in a bit of a difficulty because what do I put there? It's on the form, are you male or female? And I've crossed female because that was, you know, how I was living and what I thought my official documentations were about. But it's been found that, or it was found at the time, that certain people had their insurance invalidated because although they might have passports that say they're female, their birth certificate says male. And the insurance company says, well, actually, sort of like you've filled it in wrong. You've actually, in particular, when it came to things like driving insurance, oh, you were trying to defraud us.
Which until very recently was a very, very different situation.
You
paid very different if you were a man or a woman, for example.
That's right. So you could find yourself convicted of fraud and you certainly would have your insurance invalidated.
It was the other way around. So had you put down male in line with your birth certificate, but your passport was out of sync with that.
Yes, precisely. So you'd have that problem with both, whatever you'd actually write. And the only way around it was to give an explanation in the, you know, anything else to declare sort of section of these forms. And you'd often find that you'd pay an additional premium because of it. But not everyone, you know, knew that they would have to fill in those particular details, and so found themselves unintentionally subjected to fraud cases.
Things that some of us never have to consider.
Literally ever.
That suddenly do. So we've obviously fast forward. What have been some of the unintended consequences or just are the new realities of the Gender Recognition Act that people would want to change?
Yeah, so I don't think there's been any unintended consequences. The trouble was the Gender Recognition Act was very pioneering at the time. It was a Labour government and it led the world in recognising people should be able to change their gender on their birth certificate. But because of it was one of the first, it was a very lengthy process, very highly medicalised, very highly legal. You'd require lots of documents to actually prove that you had transitioned, and it would take 2 years. And so you'd find yourself in that same legal limbo that I was talking about for your insurance for at least 2 years before you got your gender recognition certificate. And the gender recognition certificate is what changes your birth certificate, just to explain that. So
we're talking about things like it's quite expensive. So it costs hundreds of pounds to do the actual fee for the form, but then you had to go and get medical tests that you had to pay for each time, I believe.
Well, yes, certainly some sort of like medical tests you'd have to pay for. But also just in terms of just waiting for an NHS appointment, that would take 2 years, and then you'd have to wait for another 6 months after your first appointment before a doctor would actually sort of fill in the form confirming that you have had gender dysphoria and you should be able to change your birth certificate.
And that medicalised nature is one of the things that people come back to time and time again. So the fact that this concept of gender dysphoria suggests there's a kind of mental health implication for being trans, which of course has stigma with it and suggests somehow.
Well, I mean, and it's also sort of like if we go back, you wouldn't feel as if you were gay, bisexual or lesbian, that you'd have to go to a doctor to have an approval of, yes, you are one of those sexualities. And yes, it was always labelled previously a long time ago as a mental health issue. And then people have realised actually, no, there's lots of people that you acquired this at birth or might realise your gender later on is gender identity is different. But there's nothing at all mental health.
You're not unwell because
you're
of
not
it,
unwell. You might be unwell. You might have mental health issues because
that's transphobia,
society.
Though.
Yeah, exactly. The society treats you very badly, but not for that. Not for the reason for being trans in the first place.
And I think other people in the LGBT community would relate to that very heavily, wouldn't they?
Absolutely. And I think also, one of the what I was just about to kind of say was, as someone, particularly as a lesbian woman, when I go to the doctors and things like that, the experiences I often have are appalling. So like the idea of, what is meant to be something that is very mainstream in lots of ways of people's understanding of, whether that
be... It has certainly moved on more than trans issues has.
Exactly. But that's my point is, even though it has moved on that far in comparison to trans issues, it is still always a very negative experience when I go. So I can't even imagine how negative the experience can be when a trans person tries to get through that kind of medical process and system.
Yes, I mean, certainly certain GP practices, I think there was one area in particular, wouldn't actually treat transgender people with their hormones, wouldn't prescribe them. And this is called out in the Women's Inequality Report on transgender in 2016.
Surely that contravenes the Equality Act.
It probably does, but I mean, in terms of enforcement of it, I mean, it's like everything.
Because those Tories still haven't implemented various clauses of the Equality Act. Who knew?
Yes.
What a shocker.
Yeah. But I mean, I think it's important to realise just because you have rights on paper doesn't mean that it's actually easy to enforce them. And if you've got to go through court cases, especially if you're feeling mentally vulnerable, and we don't have legal aid for most things now as well, then it's very difficult to enforce your actual rights.
But also, like, imagine an entire, area of the country going, no, we're not going to hand out contraception anymore.
Ridiculous.
Like, we're just not going to engage in that, no. We don't agree with that. Like, there would be an absolute outrage.
Yeah. And so one of the other cases for reform has been to restore confidentiality. So I think you alluded to this previously, that one of the aspirations and the attempts of the original Gender Recognition Act was to provide some confidentiality for people. Explain to people what was the aim and what was the reality?
Yes, okay. So, I mean, perhaps a couple of examples. So before the Gender Recognition Act was passed, I was at Cambridge University and I made a complaint of sexual harassment. And the university published in or sent out a press release about my complaint saying that I was transgender. And I had no recourse to actually deal with the university over that particular issue. So the Gender Recognition Act in part was to sort of like say, look, your gender is confidential to you. What your original birth gender was assigned as is confidential to you, and you should have various protections. And the Gender Recognition Act put those in place. But unfortunately,
that meant, for example, you couldn't access the original birth certificate.
That meant that only a very few officials for very particular reasons could access those particular birth certificate, original birth records. But unfortunately, no one foresaw in 2004 that the internet would be so wonderful in so many ways. You can look up your ancestral tree, your family history, but that also means that you can look up someone's who's not related to you at all, their actual original birth records. And so what you do have at the moment is some particularly nasty people around who feel it's their duty to expose any trans person, going around trying to find the original birth records and then publishing that online. And it's totally negated that original basis of the Gender Recognition Act.
And that hopefully, so a reformed act could try to tidy that up in some way.
So
and make it an offence, I assume, to go and publish other people's data.
Yes, yes. I mean,
it's malicious, right? Nobody's doing it to be helpful. It's not like they're like, oh, you lost this.
Yes.
Here it is again.
You may have forgotten.
Yeah, you may have forgotten. It's malicious.
Yes, it is. And I mean, because so even now, although perhaps I glossed over it, although a lot of people in especially sort of like liberal workplaces are fine and liberal areas are fine with people being transgender, there is a significant number of people who are quite nasty. And
most people would assume that Cambridge University was at the liberal end of these things.
Yes.
Now, that might have been a while ago and things might have changed, but, you know...
Well, Cambridge is 30 years.
Sometimes good people get it wrong.
Yeah. Well, Cambridge is 30 years ahead in terms of certain research and certain values, and 30 years behind in a Porterhouse blue like way on certain issues. And it was that particular older group who were the difficulty there. I mean, the student union was brilliant, and you know, many of my colleagues were brilliant. But So that, I mean, and to just point out how damaging that is. Now, I'm quite happy to be out as transgender, but if I wasn't, okay, I might have wanted to actually restart my life elsewhere and was quite happily, you know, with other people. And then someone looks it up on the internet and says, oh, look, did you know Heather was previously, and then, you know, gives out information about my transgender status. So I think, you know, it's important for people's confidentiality to be able to, you know, decide themselves if they want to tell people.
Yeah, you should be able to own that situation. And one of the other things is that you can't get a gender recognition certificate until you are post 18. And so there's calls to bring that down to 16 or with parental consent to change that altogether.
Yes, I mean, 18 was chosen, but I mean, you get your driving license at 17. So, I mean, you know, people can recognise their own gender identity very early on, and there's lots of people that do. And for those people, they want to be able to change their gender, want to change their birth certificate as soon as they possibly can. And I mean, let's face it, people who, when they go out drinking, okay, you can't drink at 16. It's one of those forms of identity that you use to actually show your age, isn't it?
And so some of this about the current system that's been particularly difficult is that it goes to a tribunal, essentially, that you never meet, totally faceless, that decides the fate of people they never meet and will never go on to meet. And then whatever they decide, you have no right to appeal. And I'm going to go into a difficult area here, because it is good practice and LGBT Labour's policy, of which you're obviously the trans officer, to not ask people about whether they've gone through this process of having a gender recognition certificate, because people should be able to go for that. You've agreed to talk to us about the experience that you have to help kind of campaign on this issue. So can you tell us a little bit what that was like, putting your fate in the hands of people?
Yes.
I assume you've never met.
I certainly hadn't met. And I mean, the forms themselves were very complicated. So, I mean, I've got a PhD and I really needed it to actually understand every particular thing.
I hate literally nothing more than filling out forms. Like, yeah. I basically come out in hives.
Yes.
Dyslexia within me means that literally I have to do them about 10 times.
Yes. I mean, and this would certainly bring you out in hives. It's it was complicated enough in the first place. And of course, you had to then put lots of painful medical details in and other bits of proof to show that you had transitioned. Now, one of the things they ask for is when you have switched your name, if you've changed it by deed poll, they want to see the original deed poll. Now, I had changed my name some 20 years before with the deed poll, and I've got all my passports and everything else in my new name. I'd been homeless and sleeping in the meantime. So I didn't have access to all those previous records, and they actually declined me for not actually having that deed poll form, even though, as I said, I'd proved to everyone, you know, in terms of showing the passport and everything else, that was the name I was using. And I wasn't allowed to have a gender recognition certificate, and it took a very long time and lots of battles to actually reapply and overcome that.
How did that make you feel?
Well, very disappointed because, I mean, well, yeah, it cost a lot in the first place. It was quite emotionally draining as well, just because actually facing anything which reminds you about your, shall we say, that reminds you about your past and some of the difficulties you might have had just facing the world as a transgender person was difficult. And then I've got to go through it all over again. And it's almost like someone says, oh, well, you're not really transgender. So it's sort of like, and you know, we haven't met, not being able to appeal. In fact, they are technically wrong about the need for a deed poll, because one of the other things that the Equality Committee has actually said is that actually legal names, you can actually just call yourself what you want. Okay, you don't actually have to go through a deed poll. And certainly this is a bureaucratic hurdle too far to actually insist on actually seeing the original change of name.
So let's try and move to what's being campaigned for. So I believe LGBT Labour, which obviously you're the trans officer of the campaign, you speak for every trans person in the country and what they're arguing for. But there is some consensus around what I believe is kind of viewed as the kind of Irish model. So the Republic of Ireland in 2015, I believe, passed legislation allowing people to have a gender recognition certificate based on self-definition as the proposing system. So this has been chosen partly because we have similar legal systems. It allows people to change their gender through this self-determination mechanism. Explain a little bit how that works and what you therefore go through instead of a medicalized process. What then happens?
So basically that would involve you applying for a form. So I'm just fortunately, still more forms with still more hives, but
I've come
a lot
to accept
more,
that.
Yes, a lot more simple. And that form would basically say that you intend to live in your gender that you're expressing for the rest of your life. And then you declare something called a statutory declaration saying, I will live in that gender for the rest of my life. And this actually is quite a powerful form. It's not something trivial to just sign off on, because if you actually falsely give a declaration, a statutory declaration, you can find yourself imprisoned for up to 2 years. Okay. So it's actually sort of like...
Under
the Perjury Act, yes. Yep. So actually when people say, oh, well, it's as simple as, you know, people just do it frivolously, etc., that they wouldn't, because they would get into a lot of trouble if they did. And then that would go off and you'd hopefully be issued your gender recognition certificate and all the privacy and everything else that would come with that.
And so the privacy part of that in the Irish model is a lot stronger, isn't it? That's one of the things that's very good about it.
Yes. I mean, I'm not an expert on Irish law, but yes, I mean, that's part of the idea of updating it and for MPs and the you know, and Lords to actually work out the best way of actually protecting people's privacy.
And I believe that one of the things is that they have brought down the age for about to apply for it. At 16, you can apply to a judge to ask for the kind of permission to go through the process.
Yes, I mean, that again, is a sensible way of saying, look, people can determine, you know, how they think at the age of 16, etc. But let's just have, in Ireland, it was thought, just have an extra hurdle to overcome, just to check, you know, that everything is all in place. But I think it's pretty much automatic, unless if there is a reason why you'd say, oh, someone can't really determine for themselves at that particular age why they should actually have change your gender.
The other opportunity to reform is to get rid of something known as the spousal veto. So do you want to explain that to people, what that is and where that comes from?
So before the Equal Marriage Act, it might cause a problem if suddenly sort of like someone changes their gender and in relation to their current marriage. So what the original act said was, okay, well, you'd need the permission of your current spouse to actually change your gender. And that was called the spousal veto. And you'd either have to get divorced or there would be a long process in which that was then disputed if your partner refused to give it. And the trouble is that's then been used in ways of messy divorces, sort of like saying, well, I'll only sign off your, I'll only give you the spousal permission if you actually agree to my terms on the divorce. And it, again, it sort of like puts people in a legal limbo for an extra six months they don't need to have. So yes, the idea is to get rid of the spousal veto.
And so the change that we're talking about, moving to self-declaration, has been done in Argentina in 2012, in Denmark in 2014. We've talked about Ireland already in 2015, but also done in Malta, Norway and Colombia. And there seems to be no reports there of people kind of gaming the system. All this kind of hysteria that's out there that people are going to do it as a one-off. When they go into prison, they'll then declare so they can be in another prison, so they're going to abuse people, or this horrendous stuff where people are going to voluntarily do it so they can turn up at women's refuges to find their former partner. This hasn't been experienced in any of the jurisdictions.
It's not been found in any other jurisdiction. And I think this is actually one of the confusions. All of those things about access to women's prisons and refuges, etc., they all come under the Equality Act, which is actually completely separate to what's actually being proposed to be changed. So actually, the Gender Recognition Act gives you, if you change your birth certificate, it gives you no extra rights to actually have extra rights in the Equality Act. Okay, the Equality Act allows for certain exceptions if it's proportionate to a legitimate aim. So there are bodies could choose to say, look, this is a reason why we'd need to exclude a transgender person, and then exclude them because they say, well, that's legitimate. But actually what we even find on those particular cases is it doesn't happen.
Much reported about on Twitter and the, for instance, is the whataboutery. Yeah. But if you speak to Women's Aid or the various organisations that run domestic violence services, they've thought this stuff through. They've had many of these issues. There are sometimes separate beds available for trans people, I believe. But also they haven't actually come up against the sense of abuse that people argue that they fear in some of our newspapers.
Yes, and Scotland, which has actually undergone a consultation process already, all those services, the Women's Domestic Refuge Services and Rape Crisis Services, have all come out supporting the need to change the Gender Recognition Act and saying we've never had problems in terms of our services on the Equality Act, which is completely separate.
That's really welcome and really positive to see going forward. And one of the sad things about this debate is it was kicked off by this report led by a Tory. The government then said they would try and take this forward when Justin Greening was Equalities Minister and the Education Secretary. And for whatever reason, she could never quite get around to doing it, which did seem to be, from the outside, to look about as much about her colleagues than her own intentions, to be fair to her. And now she's left government, it slightly seems to have died.
Yeah, so it was announced just before the summer recess that there would be this consultation and then change of the Gender Recognition Act to self-declaration. And they said the consultation would be in the autumn, and then sort of like it's been kicked back. And, you know, it's always, oh, well, it'll be sometime next month. That's been the constant.
But to be fair to them, the SNP government have done their own inquiry, and it's come to very similar, their own consultation, sorry, and it's come to similar conclusions. I think it's important at this stage to mention non-binary, because the current Gender Recognition Act doesn't really give provision for non-binary ordinary people, but there have been pioneers around the world. Malta and Argentina that have been previously mentioned, New South Wales, the state in Australia, Oregon and California, the states in the USA, have allowed provisions for non-binary people to be legally recognised. Do you think that's something we need to try and explore as part of this?
I think we do. I mean, at the moment, there is a legal case going about through the courts about whether someone can have their passports, instead of having M or F, male and female, whether they can have X. And as you say, in Australia, for example, you're allowed to do that. And actually, that applies worldwide, because I think it's the Civil Aviation Authority, the worldwide body of that, actually says that's quite a valid thing, not to actually have a gender marker or to have a neutral gender marker on your form. So
if one country's done it, then everywhere's done it, because there is a central body that processes your passport when you go through customs.
That's right. So, I mean, and if that becomes the case in terms of you can change your passport to be registered as X, why not, as we said before, sort of like you'll find that there's loads of problems with your insurance and everything else. You should be able to change your birth certificate and have your non-binary gender recognised. But it is controversial because the tone of the debate has been so poor because of this Twitter debate where people haven't been rationally talking about. I mean, very few people know what non-binary is. And, you know, they then will say their worst fear. This is a person that might be non-binary and we're going to pretend everyone is like that particular person. We're not having a rational debate.
So while not seeking to speak for all non-binary people, do you want to give a sense of definition for those people who've not come across that previously?
Yes. Okay. So my normal job is as a scientist, and I like putting things in boxes because so we're probably all happy to stick things into a male or female box. But actually, that is oversimplification. Oversimplification. And some people would say, look, being male doesn't entirely suit my, you know, model of myself. Being female doesn't entirely suit my model of myself. Or I might be both. So non-binary as a general umbrella term is anything that doesn't fit the binary.
Yep.
So, I mean, it's the clue is in its name. So anything that sort of like doesn't fit these two boxes.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think one of the things I really wanted to come back to that Heather mentioned before was about that kind of tone of the debate. And I came into politics through my feminism. That was totally what brought me in. And it was through that I had the confidence to kind of come out as a lesbian. So, you know, lots of part of my identity comes from my kind of feminism before it comes from anything else. And I think the tone of the debate on kind of every side has become so extreme and so entrenched in some of the most damaging ways that, you know, it's one of those things where it kind of highlights sometimes how people's rights can conflict at times. And it's a difficult thing to acknowledge and understand, but it's also true. And I think one of the things that I think I've seen, particularly within the Labour movement, that I think has been really positive is the kind of discussions that LGBT Labour and certain women's groups, so like Fabian Women's Network, LWN, like there's been a really good sense of engagement about, right, what are the actual issues? What could be the situations where this could have a level of confliction? And how do we sort that stuff out? You know, as you say, and it's about what's the true fact in all of this? Like what's actually being asked to be proposed and changed, and not what's the scandal and the headline and the extremities on all sides that people come up with?
Well, so let's get into some of this debate. So the parliamentary committee looked into the decision, says there should be change, and there was a backlash, let's be honest. And one of the things that you expected the Express, the Mail, the Sun maybe, to take sometimes the traditional position that those papers have taken, and certainly one that many gay men in particular will recognise as the kind of headlines that were used against them in the 80s and 90s, particularly around HIV crisis as it was then, and you're seeing that. But one of the things that I think has saddened me most is the way the Sunday Times has been almost the cheerleader for some of this. I know, Steph, you've identified some of the vile headlines that came up.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is literally just over the last kind of couple of months, you've got terrified patient treated like transphobic bigot. A woman claims a hospital puts the right of male-bodied fellow patient first. And it's, you've got another one, up to half of trans inmates may be sex offenders. And it's just like... Yeah.
So I mean, that one in particular is so, I mean, this is Andrew Gilligan, who doesn't have the I think that's by Andrea.
And it's literally, it's got a little headline, a little subheadline, transgender investigation. It's like, what are you talking about?
Yeah. So, I mean, so for example, okay, that where that came from was this, trans prisoners are often vulnerable to assaults, sexual assaults in prison. So they often go into areas which are protected. And also in those protected areas happen to be sex offenders occasionally. So the conclusion was, anyone who's in the sex offender...
Two and two must equal seven.
Yes, that's it. Anyone in that particular...
How helpful.
That's not journalism, people.
Yeah. I expect better.
I do expect better from the Sunday Times, is the honest truth. I do expect better from the Sunday Times.
Yeah. And I mean, and those sort of like fear, sort of like stories put around. I mean, you know, and it used to be the case that lots of people would who are transgender would be labelled as paedophiles and then...
Well, gay people used to be labelled as paedophiles.
Precisely.
You know,
it's that particular sort of like notion of, let's find a reason why other people should hate this minority because we've got to feel we've got to have a justification for hating people.
Yeah.
And I've got a brilliant briefing from Unison, the trade union that's obviously Labour affiliated, that's looked into some of these issues. And they go through whole areas where myths have come about and makes very clear the GRA reform does not affect hate crime law, for example, which some people are trying to suggest that it would. It does not affect the Equality Act. That is a totally different bit of discrimination. Nobody is trying to change the protections or exemptions that exist for trans people or for other groups in that. It does not affect sports competitions. It doesn't affect how the NHS might work or its medical treatments. It doesn't affect who might go into what changing rooms in Top Man or Top Shop or whatever the place might be. It doesn't affect whole areas that people seem to have got into, particularly single-sex services and facilities. Those rules will be maintained because the law is seen as fair. At the moment, the exemptions seem to work and they've not identified any problems. And it doesn't allow people to flip-flop their genders. I think you explained earlier how this isn't people willy-nilly. Is that the right? Probably not the right thing to say on this. To just change, they're not going back and forward, flip-flopping in this way. You have to make a kind of serious affidavit to go through this process.
And as we say, sort of like going back to the international examples where this has happened in Ireland, Argentina, etc., there have been no examples where this system has been abused. And going back, it is a separate act, the Equalities Act. It allows certain exceptions. But as I also say, it's sort of like it's very rare that those exceptions are ever necessary. A lot of fear out there is actually not what the practice is on the ground, because actually people are quite reasonable.
So finally, I want to turn to the situation in the Labour Party, because this, of course, is a debate in society and that's reflected in the Labour Party. But particularly, and it's been argued that the presence of all women shortlists has heightened this recently. And actually, one of the very progressive things that Labour did when it brought in all women shortlists was it said from the very outset that they will take that based on self-definition. But some people put their size 10s into the debate unhelpfully and suggested that wasn't the case. But recently, I think, Stephanie, you were even there.
Yes. I was. Yeah. So I was at the NEC Qualities Subcommittee. So I do that in one of my other hats, also on LGBT Labour's executive. And basically, because of the kind of discussion that had come out and the kind of blow up that people have had with regards to self-definition, we wanted to make it very, very clear that that had always been the case, that nothing is new here. Like, and the point of it being that nothing is new here is we haven't had any problem before. So all again, the scaremongering, the whataboutery, like none of these things had happened before. Why should they therefore start to happen now? And what was really positive at the NEC Equality Subcommittee was you saw kind of unanimously this reaffirming and clarifying statement at the last meeting that was passed, that was then to be taken to the NEC. It's done a little bit of backwards and forwards over the last couple of months of just making sure the wording of these things is right and everything else. But it was passed kind of, you know, very, very unanimously.
And nothing passes unanimously in the current Labour
Party. Literally nothing passes unanimously. But, you know, from every side and every bit of the kind of political spectrum that sits within the Labour Party, it was a really positive thing where everybody around the room just went, yep. No, I totally agree. This is really important. One of the things that I think is actually quite sad is it then goes back up to the NEC. It's getting postponed again. There's more discussion that needs to happen. And then we're seeing, you know, kind of people that have made some very offensive and hurtful statements to the trans community being invited in to consult on these issues. And actually, you know, there's a lot of ambiguity around what's going on at the moment. There's not a lot of clarity of what's going on about that at the moment. But what I think we really need to see very, very quickly from the Labour Party is a reaffirming of this for the trans community within Labour, and also kind of action taken in terms of putting out this statement and making it very, very clear. And, you know, as the party have said before, there are already safeguards to protect people that would abuse it. And actually, more people would try and abuse it to undermine the concept of all women shortlists,
yeah,
in a sense that they don't believe that they should exist in the first place, than would anything to do with the trans community or anything like that. So, yeah. What we need right now is action from the Labour Party.
Yeah, and I'd say it's been very disappointing because by keep postponing it, there is this Twitter backlash against the trans community. Yeah. Whilst
it
they
looks
think
like there's
that,
something
yes,
wrong.
And whilst these people think that they can influence policy by shouting loudly about the trans community, they shout loudly about the trans community. So we've simply postponed actually what is going to be Labour Party policy because that we are the party of equality. And it is always actually
well, we
been.
Need to we need to prove that. And I think that's the important thing right now is that...
And the bit that you just said there, which is interesting, is we're kind of holding open the window for discrimination.
Absolutely.
While we don't get this clarified. Because if it's been the case since 1993...
Well, what we're saying is that there is a reason to debate this and there is problems within this situation. That's what we're saying.
But that wasn't the NEC subcommittee's view.
That wasn't the NEC subcommittee's view at all. That is the main body of the NEC's view. Yeah.
And perhaps we should just have a look at an example, because in the year 2000, I got elected as a women's officer in Pembroke College in Cambridge. There was never any sort of like, there wasn't even Daily Mail headlines about that. Suddenly we have, because of this debate within the Labour Party, supposed debate, Lily Madigan, who becomes women's officer in her CLP, there's some really vicious, horrible things being said about Lily Madigan, who I think it's quite well known is open about being trans. That's just not acceptable. But that's happening from people within the Labour Party who are, some of them are still within the Labour Party, not being suspended or anything, throwing vile abuse online.
Yeah.
And the transgender community feels under attack. And a bit like anti-Semitism, we feel that the Labour Party is not acting quickly enough when they're given evidence of someone being really abusive. They're not at least suspending them whilst they investigate further.
And what form has that abuse taken? What have you seen on social media?
There's a great deal of dead naming of people. So this is whereby someone's original name is actually said, and any photos that might have been of them before they transitioned have been put out. There's a lot of modifications of photographs of people where they then put offensive comments up about, sort of like, this is what a misogynist looks like, over a picture of Eddie Izzard or myself, etc. So, and those are things that have been published. And of course, they're memes that get shared around on the Twitter. And then, you know, people like myself have found that there have been attempts to out our original birth certificates and other things that are then put on the net, such as my dress and everything. And then I find myself subject to identity fraud because all of these details, which, you know, people...
Oh my God, how horrid.
Yeah. You know, it's been quite a nightmare. And I mean, just in terms of, you know, I stood on an all-women shortlist, and the people within the constituency that I had to, which I was trying to be selected for, they were fine. They were all supportive. But there was a sort of like a Twitter storm and an email storm being sent sort of like to me. Literally, my whole inbox was always full each day with sort of like abusive comments. And then, of course, I've got the difficulty of filtering out those abusive comments and actually dealing with constituents' comments.
Yeah.
So, you know, those are current difficulties and we don't seem to be able to tackle it within the Labour Party at the moment, sadly.
Well, thank you very much, Heather, for being part of what has been a fascinating and I think wide-ranging conversation on the issue. I think we're all with you on getting the real changes to the law that are very necessary for the Gender Recognition Act to be able to function in a modern situation and to follow the best practice that is there in Ireland. Maybe had we not had a Tory government, we would have been leading the way on this initially. Certainly. So thank you for talking to us about that, Heather, and good luck with your NEC election and your campaigning in the coming days for that election. wider LGBT issues have been in the press in the last few weeks because of the Commonwealth meeting and, of course, Tom Daley's success in the Commonwealth competition that he was part of, where, of course, he won gold for Britain. And he used the opportunity of competing as an openly LGBT diver and the fact that him and his partner are about to have a child and bring a baby into this world and become parents together, that I think lots of people have become very happy about. I certainly smiled a lot when I heard the news and was very, very pleased for them. And he conflated those two things and reflected back what that experience might be to not be an openly LGBT participant in the Commonwealth Games going forward. And Theresa May, of course, apologised for Britain being the people that put these anti-LGBT legislation in a number of countries around the world and has essentially offered a hand of friendship for those who seek to change the laws on that.
Absolutely. This is where we had a fun bit of controversy in the office earlier when we were discussing this, because I love Tom Daley, probably not as much as the next gay man, but I love him. He's a good lad.
You don't love him that much, not enough.
I do. However, and I think his intentions are so good. Like, I think they come from literally the best place in terms of where he's coming from, in terms of his intervention on this. But I don't actually think it's very helpful. And there are a number of reasons that I don't actually think it's very helpful for. And I think, firstly, as you say, and you said very quickly, you need to remember the context of which these laws were made in. They were not, you know, just made at the point where this was just the history, this is what always thought. Like, we imposed as a colony, when we colonized these countries, we imposed the penal codes that made this illegal as a country. Like, we created it.
Tom Daley didn't.
Yes. But listen to the whole point of it. I'm not saying Tom Daley made them, but we are the UK. Theresa May is the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, and she is reaching out her little olive branch, despite the fact about, 15 years ago, she used to vote against us all the time anyway. So, but there is a difference between the fact of what's going to be the right tactic to do this, right? I personally think lots of this comes down to a bit of virtue signalling, because I think it makes us feel really good. I think it makes us instinctively feel like it's the right thing to do. But actually, I think on the ground, in the countries where these laws still exist, because we put them there, but where now the attitude of homophobia is so deep-rooted, but also where the attitude in lots of ways of anti-colonial attitude of, we have fought so hard for our independence from this. There's a difference between part of the Commonwealth Games and playing sport and being part of the Commonwealth Games and the legislation that goes with that. And I think for me, what's really important is that we need to be working with the LGBT people in those communities and in those countries, and doing it very loudly and publicly, and as quite honestly as Tom Daley, Theresa May, as white British people, saying that this is what we should be doing, actually isn't very helpful, because it's seen as a very Western way of looking at things, when actually there are phenomenal LGBT like movements that are happening in those countries. And what we need to be doing is quite quietly, and it's difficult because we like to say things very loudly and proudly as a community in lots of ways, but actually, like, we need to be working with the people that are LGBT within those countries that are doing the most amazing fights and campaigns to be able to make change the culture of their countries from within, and not see this as a kind of virtue signaling way of doing things.
Before Heather rushes in, I just want to look. I think many of us agree with the sensitivities that you have put forward, but I would maybe argue this: has Tom Daley not been the platform for some of those domestic LGBT groups to have the issues raised higher up the agenda, and them to get their issues raised in a way that moves things forward? And also, has Tom Daley not shown some solidarity with those people, that the struggle that you're part of is worth it, that it can get better and it will get better, that other people are wishing you well in that fight? Because that is one of the things that, if you are fighting for equality in a place where you don't have the direction of travel with you, knowing that other people in other places you might never have met are wishing you well in that fight can sometimes be the bit that keeps you going.
I think that's true. I'm not sure necessarily that everybody that is fighting this fight will necessarily know who Tom Daley is. Like, I know the concept of that to you, Richard, blows your mind. But you have to remember where it is that we're talking about in lots of these places, the culture that sits within those. And I think, as much as this is what I mean, like, I think all of this is good intention. Do I think practically it's what's going to change anything? No.
Yeah, but the key issue about raising it about the Commonwealth and in the Commonwealth Games is sometimes you can't work with the LGBT communities in those particular countries because it is illegal, or those people face serious actual action, violent action against them. So I think, you know, there is a particular point of actually all governments, I mean, the British government, but also European governments, etc., saying, look, rights across the world need to improve. I will just say this, we should lead by example. And one of the troubles with this government is their asylum policy. And particularly for the bisexual and transgender community, people who are claiming asylum, who are bisexual or transgender, and have been discriminated against in their country and face a serious consequence, they often find that they can't claim asylum.
Well, exactly. There are lesbian women who are told, well, you've had a child before, so you can't be a lesbian because at some point you've had a child.
Yeah.
So when Theresa May cleans up her own act, she can take a little hypocrisy elsewhere, personally.
But, yes, I think she should do it in parallel.
You just missed Steph Lloyd dropping the mic.
Literally, while she deports LGBT people because they can't prove that they are gay, and this was while she was in the Home Office and everything else, like, I'm sorry, Theresa, but nah. I don't think you're going to change the world on LGBT rights somehow.
I was arguing Tom Daley was, not Theresa May, but I think we all see that going forward. Very final thing is, how do we be better allies in this debate? So trans people feel like they're under attack. I think that's something that you just said. What can we all do to be better allies?
Yeah, so I think if you see transphobia, either when trans people are present or when they're absent, you should call it out and make sure that people know it's not acceptable. Correct any misinformation if you can. So that's one of the reasons why the Labour Party is putting up a trans ally network information, and so is
we'll link to that in the show notes so people can sign up to it.
And so is Unison, which is a bit more advanced on that than we've got so far, to actually contradict a lot of these myths and these falsities.
And but it's transphobia whether there's a trans person in the room or not. They doesn't have to be there to be offended for it to be transphobia. And it's like on the anti-Semitism issue, if you hear transphobia, it's for you to say, hold on, that's offensive. I don't want that being said in my presence. That's not welcome in our club rules.
Very much so. And I think the other thing is, if you know a trans person who's coming out at work, etc., is to be supportive and understand that. I was saying to someone earlier, sort of like when I first transitioned, okay, I'd not made all the teenage fashion mistakes that my colleagues had made, and I suddenly made those over a 2-year period, and it was quite embarrassing. But so
I've got haircuts that need to resign themselves to the bin forever.
This is the trouble with the internet. It records everything. So I think the point is just be supportive of people who are trans and, as you say, call out transphobia.
Well, Heather, thank you so much for joining us to be part of this debate. I think we've covered a whole range of issues there. We wish you well, and we'll be at your side and supporting you as both Progress and, I'm sure, through LGBT Labour to campaign for this very necessary change in the law and to try and fight back in some of the public space where people are trying to muddy the water or just be downright hateful. We encourage people to join the LGBT Labour Trans Ally Network. And like Steph said, there'll be a link below. But thank you very much for being part of this discussion. So every week, Connor asks his political pub quiz question, and it's answered on the Friday Review Show. Connor's on holiday still, and he's not with us this week. So Steph, what's your question this week?
The question is, which US president refused to use a telephone in the White House?
Ooh, I have no idea. But if you know, send your answers to @progressonline on Twitter or email office@progressonline.org.uk with a chance to win, you guessed it, a Progress mug. We've got to wrap up the show now. We've been delighted to have Heather Pito on with us this week. Please send your questions, comments and suggestions for our follow-up show by Twitter, email, or put your review on iTunes. If you leave an iTunes review, it helps us get up the iTunes charts and gets this podcast to people who don't already hear it. If you rate the podcast, it does the same. And of course, if you subscribe to the podcast, it means it comes to your phone at 6 a.m. in the morning every Tuesday and Friday when we go live. So thank you very much for your support and thank you for listening.
You You've been listening to the Progressive Britain podcast. The music was When in the West by Blue Dot Sessions, licensed under Creative Commons. And many thanks to the brilliant Caroline Crampton, who produced this podcast.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.